Hi, and welcome to the Early Years Learning Hub podcast. My name is Jackie Ward, and I'm the founder and managing director of the Early Years Learning Hub. And this is the very first in our series titled Practice Sharing, where I, as a teacher, will talk to other teachers and educators and leaders on a range of topics that I think are interesting, or I think the person that I'm talking to does whatever it is really well. Which brings me to who I'm talking to today about assessment and planning, and that is a teacher that I am very in awe of. Her name is Lauren Tinsley, and she is a super clever and talented teacher, has a beautiful manner and just very reflective and thoughtful in her work. And I had a conversation with her one time about the assessment and planning cycle, and I thought that my listeners would love to hear that. So over to you, Lauren. Would you like to give yourself a little bit of an intro?
Hi, thanks for having me, Jackie. I really appreciate it. I've been an early childhood teacher for about 11 years, and I've worked across long daycare, preschool, out-of-school hours care, and also a little bit of casual work in primary schools. And I've always been fairly passionate about early childhood from quite a young age, so I think it's just great being able to work with the kids and having time with them and getting to know their families and all of that sort of thing.
That's awesome. That's a really broad range of experience, which I'm sure helps you to develop your practice, I guess. For me, that's something that I've always thought is helpful when you've had a bit of experience in different settings and in different services or schools or whatever it might be. It helps you get a bit of, you know, you gather up ideas along the way. And I don't think I mentioned in my intro of you too, I think one of the things is that you're just probably a little bit like me and a really naturally critically reflective practitioner, which I think also helps, doesn't it, to try and figure out better ways of doing things and making things easier and less complicated. So I think that, you know, lots of our listeners will probably be listening in going, oh, the assessment and planning cycle. You know, a lot of people do kind of struggle to get their head around what they need to do and what each part means and how they might manage to write it all down. So that's kind of what we're talking about. So I guess I'd like to start off with that very basic notion, you know, like what's your understanding of the planning cycle and how have you gotten your head around it?
I mean, it is, when you first start, definitely it seems quite overwhelming because there's so many components, and when you're used to just doing it in theory in your course and then having to translate that into actually practicing, and especially if you're a room leader or ECT or something like that, you know, taking leadership of that and being responsible for the whole cycle, it can be quite overwhelming. But once you kind of get used to working with the children every day and doing the things that are part of the cycle, it sort of becomes quite natural, I think. Even if we weren't educators, even if we were working in a different place, or if we were even just with our own children or, you know, nieces, nephews, that kind of thing, you know, you do naturally watch what children do and think about what that means about that child and respond to it and adapt to what you have done based on what you've observed of them. So it is quite a natural process, I feel like.
I love that you've said that, Lauren, because I think that that's kind of often the way that people don't realize that they're doing a good job at something, because they think it has to be harder or difficult, or they don't recognize that practice as good practice. So I would 100% agree. I've got some grandbabies and I do the same thing, you know, like my little 4.5-year-old grandson. I know that he's really lacking in confidence now with his, you know, doing anything creative arts wise. And I'm like, I said to his mum, I said, oh, well, I'll work on that next time, you know. So yeah, I'm implementing the planning cycle with them with as just part of what you naturally do when you work with children and you're trying to support them to learn and grow. Can we have a bit of an unpack of each stage? Because again, one of the things I really like the way your brain works, Lauren, it's different from the way my brain works, but one of the things I think is it's great to sort of really unpack each stage and really have a good look at it from an understanding it point of view, and then knowing that you don't have to separate it all and it can all be a little bit integrated. But start with, it's good to know what is it and how do I need to do the gathering of information. For example, what's your take on each stage?
So people are going to be coming from different levels of experience and knowledge of the cycle itself. But, you know, if we break it down really basic, the first stage of observe is just about watching the children and seeing what they like, what their personality is, the things that they're really enjoying or the things that that are really important to them, which helps to inform your understanding of that child. And so the observe phase of the cycle for me is really tuning into the child and what it is that really drives them and, you know, makes them as a person, and just being noticing that and being mindful of that.
I would agree on that. I really think of my catchphrase that I always use with that first stage is like knowing what children can do. What are their funds of knowledge? You know, like really finding out all the things that they can do, because that's the basis of where you're going to build on. And the notion, I think, as you mentioned, about how you learn about things in whatever course you've done, it's often very minute, isn't it? And often people think that they need to focus in on writing down a specific moment in time, whereas I think what you've just described there seems to me a little bit like my approach. It's just getting a broader picture of the children and also how the information or that picture as it relates to the learning outcomes and the key components as well, you know, like what can they do in relation to that? Because ultimately the assessment and planning cycle is centered around what we're doing is collecting information and planning for learning in relation to the learning outcomes and key components.
Yeah, and I guess during study often things are fragmented because you're not actually observing real children necessarily, and it can be hard to kind of understand that what you're doing is building your understanding of a child's abilities as a whole. And so it's not just distilled down to a 5-minute observation or one interaction that you might have seen or had with the child. It's more about a holistic picture of that child and where they're at.
And it's funny, I really focused in on this year in my practice on really, you know, trying to draw on children's funds of knowledge and really question children a lot more and listen to what they already know. And to be honest, I think that I've probably had a year where I was flabbergasted, really, at how much the 4- and 5-year-olds in my preschool actually did know about stuff, really complicated stuff. And I think perhaps in the past as a practitioner, I wasn't delving deeply enough into what they already did know.
I think our courses do a great job of helping us understand children, but it's that experience that you get over time that really makes you realize that we're not the experts in the room. You know, they're the experts of their own learning. And so, and maybe just being able to trust the process that you can sort of take a backseat a little bit in that regard, because the children do know what they're doing.
Yeah, that's very true. That's very true. And I think probably as we move on now to that sort of assessment analysis, I think there's lots of conjecture out there about, you know, urban legends about, do we need to link in theorists here? Do we need to do research here? What's your thoughts about the analysis, assessment, interpreting, learning stage?
I suppose this is something else that comes with a bit of experience, but my understanding of it is that you're drawing on that knowledge that you have of the theorists, of the learning outcomes, of your experiences of that child and all of those things as you're doing your analysis. And so I personally don't put theorists into my analysis, for example, but I trust that as I'm analyzing this particular observation or, you know, a collection of observations of a child or a group of children, that I am drawing on that knowledge because I do know those things. Obviously, it's helpful when you're starting off if you are a bit shaky on the theory and you know, need a bit of refreshment there. But I think as you become more confident in your own practice and your own knowledge, it's less needed to be mentioned specifically, I mean.
I would agree. I think, for me, theorists and research and anything else that makes up your professional knowledge is not something you need to incorporate into your documentation, because I don't really think that many families would be that interested in, you know, is Vygotsky's theory of, you know, zone of proximal learning, are they interested in that? But it's important that you know it as a teacher and educator, that you're planning things that are the right level of challenge, so it's not overwhelming for the child, but it's not too easy, you know. So that's kind of the way I think as well. But also, I think that sort of gives you an idea, that analysis phase of saying, okay, well, how does this learning relate to the learning outcomes? And then what's my goal for the next level of that, you know, learning outcome or whatnot? So I really think that analysis part is going, that, you know, really sort of figuring out what's so what and what's next kind of thing. I don't really like those, you know, people use those catchphrases because, and I don't like it in the sense that it simplifies it, but that's really what you're saying, isn't it? Why is this learning significant? Why did you think about writing it down? What does it mean for that child's learning, and what does it mean for what you're going to plan for them next?
Yeah, and it gives you a sort of a chance to reflect on your observation of the child and whether or not the information that you've captured there is helpful to plan for that child's future learning.
Indeed, and often I think, is there anything else missing? Do you know what I mean? Mm. Like, oh, when you do that analysis part, I often go, actually, I'm not really sure if I know that about that child, so maybe I might need to add some more information in there, gather some more meaningful information before I progress with that one.
It informs your planning too. So if you are missing information, that's what you can plan for the future, is to learn more about that child in relation to that particular thing.
Yeah, that's a really good point. It shows, I guess, too, how all the stages are a little bit integrated, aren't they? You know, they, in reality, they're not separate steps. They're actually kind of crossing over. So what about planning? I mean, I kind of think planning is a little bit more obvious, but what sort of things would you say that you're actually writing down? Because I think this is the bit which people get confused about. I think people sometimes write a lot of the materials and resources that they're using or whatever book they're going to read rather than planning for the learning itself.
Yeah, I think the impulse or the tendency is to think about specifics like materials or a book that you're going to read or an activity that you're going to set up. But really the planning aspect needs to focus on what is your learning goal or intention for that child, because, you know, you can't always predict a day, how the day's going to run or how a week is going to run. And so if you're just planning specific materials or specific activities, you're not necessarily going to be able to achieve the learning outcome in that planned experience. So what I've moved towards doing more recently definitely is just really focusing on what is the learning intention for that child. So say I've noticed there's a particular child who's really struggling with their fine motor skills. The planning that I would do for that child wouldn't necessarily be set up a threading activity or provide a particular activity to address that. It would be support that child's fine motor skills through and then list some strategies that I might use to support them, or maybe some, you know, even just environments that I might set up, or rather than having a specific activity, because I just find it changes the way that you interact with children when you plan like that.
Yeah, I love that too. That's very much my style as well. You're planning for learning. So really, if using your example, if it's fine motor, then, you know, like if the children want to have Lego out, well, that's a great fine motor activity. But if they want to do some threading or whatever, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter the activity. You can afford children agency in choosing the provisioning of the environments because you're focused in on the learning goal itself and the strategies that accompany that learning goal, and the other things can be, you know, more sort of, I guess, child-led or child-centered.
Yeah. And that's where your intentionality comes in, because it's not just I'm going to set up this activity and I'm going to support this child to learn this skill in this activity. It's that across the whole day, across the whole week, I'm going to support this child's fine motor skills. And these are the strategies that I might use that I know will work for that child because of their interests or their personality or their developmental level or whatever. And it really can help you showcase your knowledge of the child, but also actually effectively promote their learning.
Yeah, I love that. I love the way that you've expressed that. It's perfect. And I think, you know, often for children, sometimes you've got a goal around, you know, say supporting social emotional skills or self-regulation, and those things won't be an activity, will they? They'll be, you know, the way that you support that child in their social interactions. You know, you might do an activity with them, like you might, you know, do a social skills book with them, social narrative or whatever they're called. But it's probably more likely the things that you're going to be doing is those supported interactions that you'll kind of scaffold and you'll step back on time. So it's very much that kind of learning is very much focused in on more strategies than anything else, isn't it, you know?
Yeah, and it frees you up a lot more, because those interactions don't stop when the children are having meals or when they're in the bathroom or, you know, at another point in the day. So it frees you up to be supporting them no matter what you're doing.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. Super excited to get to this bit, because I know we've sort of got a little separate topic, so we won't get into it too much, but this is one of the main things that you'd said that prompted me to say, I'd like to talk to Lauren on the podcast about this. But the implementation phase, something you mentioned, is it's where we spend most of our time. So,
yeah, it's definitely something that as I've been an educator for a longer period of time that I've come to understand a bit more about the cycle is that, you know, realistically that observe, analyze, plan phase of the cycle is sort of less important because, I mean, it's still important, obviously, but it's less, we don't spend as much time on that part of the cycle because, you know, when you have children for long periods of time, you don't always need to be revisiting the observe part of the cycle because you are working towards a goal that might be a long-term goal for that child. You know, even as we've discussed already, the fine motor skills or social emotional skills, the implementation phase is really where you get into the work of supporting the child towards that goal. And so you get to, you know, do the things that you've planned, work towards it, and then really just reflect on how has that been for that child? Have I seen progress? And I'm talking over a longer term too, because we don't put an activity out one day and then say the next day, yep, tick, that child has suddenly got really great fine motor skills. Yeah. So yeah. The implementation is really that work that we do every single day where we're working on long-term goals for a child.
Yeah, I love that. That's beautiful. And what about the last phase, critical reflection and evaluation? What's your take on that?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think implementation and the evaluation phase kind of go together as their own sort of mini cycle because you might make an initial observation of a child and plan as a result of that. And then, you know, you'll go in, you'll do whatever it is that you thought you might need to do for that child. And then you'll go and say, oh, you know, maybe that wasn't the best activity that I could have done, or maybe that strategy wasn't as effective as it could have been. So I might go and try something different. And that's really your evaluation, critical reflection. And then you go back to implementing it and then you evaluate it again and it just goes round and round and round. And then over a period of time, then you're able to look back and say, hey, actually that child has made progress in this area. And this is what I've observed over time.
Yeah, I love that. And I also think there's kind of a couple of layers with the critical reflection, like in my sort of group, you know, section where we do this in the cycle, I think about, you know, okay, what's some critical reflections on, say, my practice? I'm going to think about that, but then also a critical reflection on the program. So we're constantly always as a team at my preschool thinking about, well, is the routine or is the way we're implementing stuff, is the way we've set up our room, is it, you know, inclusive, is it working for everyone, and, you know, is it allowing for those long periods of time for children to really get into the thinking? So I think there's multiple layers. You know, there's the evaluation, which I think is that sort of how did it go, did it work or not, or what was, why didn't it work if it didn't, because that's usually why we would put something in there, isn't it? Oh, that didn't go well because whatever, I didn't allow enough time, or I wasn't organized and I didn't have my computer logged on, we couldn't get access to whatever,
or even just the children wanted to do something different with the materials that I provided.
Yeah. And sometimes that's a question of, that's just the way it rolls. But sometimes it's a question of, well, was I not really looking in that, what they were telling me? They were really telling me that they were more interested in that thing, you know, but sometimes it just changes. But I think, you know, the next thing I wanted to talk about, that implementation bit a little bit, because I think you've done a great job there. Thank you, Lauren, about summarizing the cycle and talking about that idea. But I think the implementation phase, I just wanted to come back to that a little bit. And you said that's where you spend most of your time. And you also kind of inferred there that we also spend time doing all the other parts when we're implementing, don't we? We gather up more observations of children, you know. We're listening to children. We're building our bank of knowledge of what we know about children. And we are, in a sense, when we're doing it, we're thinking to ourselves, oh, why is that significant? Or maybe we think to ourselves, you know, this is, I'm thinking the analysis phase, when we're implementing, we think about, ah, this piece and this piece fits together now and I have a better understanding of why that child is behaving in that way, for example, or I've a better understanding of how this dynamic between these two isn't great, you know, and it's great at sometimes in the morning, say, but in the afternoon, that combo of children doesn't really work. So we're kind of doing all the other phases in that implementation phase as well, aren't we?
Yeah. I feel like it's a bit less prescriptive, that phase, you know, but like observe is very clear what you're doing in that phase. And so there's not much flexibility. I mean, there still is, but there's not much flexibility around what you do. Whereas in the implementation phase, it really encompasses all the elements of our practice, including, you know, you might have a discussion with a parent about something you've observed, and then they give a really interesting, insightful anecdote about something that's happened at home or what they think about their child's progress in that area. And so I've used the word holistic already, but what I mean. It's a more holistic picture of the child and of the day and of your program and all of that.
Yeah, I think that's an action thing, isn't it? It's a doing thing. Mm. And it's a great opportunity, I think, to share some information with families in that stage and get their input, isn't it? Whether it's an individual or a group. So I love that. I love that. Now, I prefer always to talk about what we're required in our program and all that, and not mention the word documentation, because in my past experience doing lots of PL, as soon as you start talking about documentation to people, they can tend to fog over and get a bit anxious, because I think everyone's sort of overwhelmed with trying to find a way to record this information, which we're supposed to, because we're supposed to have a written program, we're supposed to have individual records for children, we're supposed to, you know, have a record of our critical reflection, things like that. So people get a bit caught up on they do complicated things, I guess, to meet the requirements of documenting each part of the cycle. So I think it's about finding a way that is easy for you, which your system, Lauren, will be different from my system, which will be different from someone else's, but also the idea of embracing the freedom of doing it your own way. Like, I know I've spoken to a lot of educators and like, why can't they just, you know, why can't a CEQA or, you know, departments of education across the country say, do it this way, you know? But I think I love the fact that we have that professional freedom to be able to find a way that works for us. And I think it'll be different in different communities, in different service types, in different management structures. And, you know, so it is good that we are able to do it differently. But I would love to hear your take on, you know, how you record each part of the cycle.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely feel that pressure, you know, especially when I first started with the documentation, because you're very time poor. You want to spend as much time as you can with the children, but also obviously you've got that requirement to make the documentation. And it can feel quite overwhelming if you're not really sure what to do. And it does seem like an easier option if somebody was to just provide you with a template and tell you fill in the boxes and, you know, you'll be done and that's it. You will have met your obligations there. But over time, I, by necessity, developed my own programming style, and the documentation sort of changes along with that. If you were to compare what I do with my documentation now compared to what I did even 3 or 4 years ago, it's quite different because, you know, my priorities have changed and the way that I do my program has changed. And I don't think you can have a template necessarily that applies to everybody that would effectively represent that. But I guess my main points are try to keep it as simple and clear as you possibly can. Like, double handling of information is really a time waster. So if you have already entered information about something and you feel the need to rewrite it to give to a parent or for some other record, just see if there's a way that you can condense what you have to do so that you only have to write it once, because it just, yeah, trying to rewrite things over and over again really is a big waste of your time. And whatever you're choosing to do for your documentation, over time you will naturally adapt it to better suit your goals, and also as your practice changes over time, as you become more experienced and, you know, you might want to change the way that you do your program, your documentation will naturally change as mine has. So, yeah, my advice is don't feel afraid to tweak what you're doing with your documentation as your practice changes over time. And something that I found really, really helpful over the years is sharing and discussing with other educators about what I'm doing, what they're doing, to really get a great, I mean, you don't have to implement exactly what everybody else is doing, but it's really great to sort of see what other people are doing, especially if you know that they've, you know, already had an assessment and rating with that, with that particular documentation style, because you know then that it's definitely meeting the requirements. And I mean, you may find that they're doing way more work than what is comfortable for you, but at least you get a kind of a sense of what other people are doing, and you can, you know, make changes to your own style to reflect what you've learned from other people and kind of adapt it. And then the last bit of advice really that I have for that is try to use the technology to consolidate your work and to simplify what you're doing as much as possible. So if your service uses an app, try to use that in a way to make your documentation more simple, because you can access it in one place rather than writing it in six different places, or, you know, keeping bits and pieces all over the place. Use the technology to keep all of your things together and make it easier to access the things that you need. So I use Microsoft products mostly to keep all of my photos and my written documentation together. And it just means that I'm not having to go and then find physical handwritten notes and bring them over so that I can finish my documentation. I just really try to keep it all within the one system.
That sounds great. And we're singing to the same song sheet there, because my top tips would be the same. Keep it really simple. Never duplicate. I can't tell you how many times I've supported services and I've looked at something that they've got that's, you know, one's a whatever daily journal and one's a something else. And I go, these two things say the same things. I go, why do you have both of those? And they're like, oh, no, they're very different. We use this for this and this. I go, well, is it a lot of work to maintain both of those? Oh, yeah, it's heaps of work. I'm like, well, maybe you could just combine them into the one thing.
Yeah, and often people, I really hate double handling.
Yeah, people are often really reluctant to let go. But I think my approach is similar to yours too, Lauren. Don't be afraid to tweak it all the time. You know, just even if you changed it 2 weeks ago, change it again if it's not working, you know. Like, and for me, last year was particularly a year where I didn't have any programming time. So I'd have to have, you know, use my own time to do that. So I was like, I don't want to do a lot of stuff online. I want to be able to write, handwrite stuff, because I can write that with the children when it's happening. So I remember what they've said and how it went down, but also, you know, how everything sort of, you know, works for you, I guess, is really the key there. And keep it simple. And the what you said about what's required, I think, is a really good segue into why people do a lot of, you know, extra work, I guess, is because they're not sure what's required. So that would be my next really key tip. Know what's important, what's required. It's so important, because if you don't, you're really just trying to sling a whole lot of mud on the wall and seeing what sticks, you know. Like, so you need to understand, you know, what's the regulatory requirements, what does the quality standards say, what does the national what are the learning frameworks say about how do you do things, and then how does that align with organizational requirements. And if the organizational requirements, you find them onerous, maybe that's a conversation you can have upline. But I'm interested to hear your take on that as well. What's your understanding of what's required in terms of legislative and quality standards?
What I think about when we're talking about this is it's almost its own little cycle in itself when you're coming up with what you're doing for your documentation and your programming, I guess. So, you know, as your practice evolves, your documentation and your programming evolves and all of that with it. And I guess that really is that critical reflection component that we're talking about there. So when you're demonstrating over time that you have reflected on your practice and your practice has adapted as a result of that, that's that critical reflection component. But yeah, so obviously critical reflection is one of the big ones that you really have to show, especially if you're aiming for the exceeding themes. And in terms of what's required, is you need to show that you're tracking individual and group progress of children over time. However you do that is up to you, but what you're doing is that you're showing that you have, through the planning cycle and through your documentation, developed an understanding, a deep understanding of every individual child's personality, interests, development, context, family, culture, all of those things, and that you have implemented planned, intentional teaching that has then led to development, which you have evaluated, and the whole cycle, basically.
Yeah, and that's a really good point, because I think that brings us back to the starting point of, you know, like gathering meaningful information. I think that's where people the wheels fall off the wagon for people originally in terms of being able to do the planning cycle, because they haven't always collected really good information and they haven't always gotten a base point to say, well, I do know this child has progressed because I know where they started and I know where they're at. And I know not everyone works in terms, but I think we could say terms or quarters, but I think that termly or quarterly sort of summative assessment of where someone's at is a great marker, you know. So rather than aiming for, I don't know, 5 observations a month or whatever, we just think of it, the idea that we've got some regular points where we're sort of checking in, if you like, if that child has progressed in their learning throughout the year, you know. So, and I think, you know, you mentioned there too, critical reflection is a good one, because assessment, it says in the standard that assessment and planning cycle should be implemented for individuals, but it's the critical reflection one that says critical reflection for groups and individuals should be driving the program. So in effect, we are doing those sort of a group cycle and we're doing an individual cycle, which kind of leads me to our last point here, is that, you know, like, I know for me, I approach that differently, because for me, I'm thinking about groups. It's really more about some of the components within the early years learning framework that about things like, for example, healthy eating. And that's also mentioned in the National Quality Standards. But and it also might mean I might be doing STEM work to build children's hypothesizing and experimenting and all those sorts of things. So sort of a little bit more like content areas like school in those group experiences, because I know I want everyone to be doing those things, protective behaviors or all that sort of learning that sort of, you know, we want everyone to do over the course of a year. And whereas for individuals, my approach is, well, I know they're getting all of that from the group stuff. What am I doing for individuals to help this individual grow and develop a sense of identity and, you know, be connected to their group, as in the, you know, the group of children that they're with, but also their community. And so there's different things that I might be doing for individuals at a different approach, I guess, as to groups. What's your take on that? How do you approach those things?
Yeah, so I'm similar in some ways in that we have, I mean, I also work in a preschool context. So there are overarching, you know, whole group sort of programs that I would be running across the year, which would include things like protective behaviors and fundamental movement skills and just different things like that, healthy eating, that sort of thing. But also when I think about planning for groups, I also think about those sort of projects that we do across the year. So, you know, at any given time, you might have a collection of children who are really passionate about a particular topic. So, you know, space or dinosaurs, or every year one that seems to come up is somebody inevitably goes to hospital for one reason or another. And so we end up with this whole big long project of learning about medical care and doctors and everything that goes on there. And I mean, obviously you plan for individual children within that project as well. But when you're planning for that kind of group activity, you are not just planning for the individual child, you're also planning for the group. And so when you set learning intentions, it's not just for one child, it's for the entire group. And when you're documenting the way that you might write individual children's names to say that this is the direction that they took it, or that's the direction that they took it. But, you know, you're still assessing and, you know, evaluating for the group rather than for individual children specifically.
Yeah, I do. I guess I probably do something a bit similar. And when I would say my learning intentions for a group would be more like related to the key components of each learning outcomes. I don't break it down any further than that, because that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to achieve that sort of, you know, key component. Whereas when I'm, you know, writing learning intentions for individual children, it will be much more personalized about that child and what I'm trying to support. And probably maybe a little bit more of a developmental focus as well, because we're, you know, it's sort of that narrower focus. But I guess, you know, again, it comes back to the fact that you're empowered to find your own way and you're empowered to do things in whatever way, shape or form works. And I think that idea that you've mentioned, that we, as long as we're showing some progress and we're showing, you know, for groups that learning that's happened throughout all the experiences and the environments and everything that we've planned for them, the projects, all of those things are contributing to growth and development. And I think the other key thing in terms of knowing the requirements and, you know, going well with assessment and rating with whatever you're doing is the confidence, you know what's required and you know what you're doing is meeting the requirements. and you're confident to speak to that.
Yeah, yeah, and that's where it comes in when you speak to other educators, and you can kind of see what other people are doing. That's why networking is so important, and having the chance to talk to different services, different service types, different educators, just to really give you a good sense of, you know, what everyone else is out there is doing. And you do kind of get a picture of, oh, well, I really closely align with what that person has said, or, you know, I don't like that person's approach, and so I'm not going to implement any of that, or things like that.
100%. Sometimes something that you don't like helps you inform what you do like. So, you know, I agree. I'm a huge fan of networking. We've got to support each other with that collegial support. You've got to have someone who's actually doing it to be able to bounce ideas off. And so, yeah, that is super important. Anyway, I realize that we've been talking for a super long time. So hopefully everyone's found it interesting. And I'm just also going to say that if anyone's interested to learn more about the assessment and planning cycle, the Early Years Learning Hub has a course, and actually quite a few courses around this: assessment and planning, critical reflection, assessment and planning for groups, and one for individuals as well, and sharing information with families. So if people are interested, they can have a look at our website, earlyyearslearninghub.com.au, and maybe have some courses. Thank you, thank you, thank you for spending your valuable time having a chat to us, Lauren. I love having a chat to you. I love the way that you've so contemplative and reflective about what you do, and so generous in sharing your practice. So thank you.
That's all right. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome.